In 166, sensing a plot by his powerful enemies, Galen slipped secretly out of the city in the nick of time. Though he claimed the plot as the reason for his abrupt exit, an impending outbreak of the plague which he had successfully identified may have been the more compelling motive. However, after a couple of years in obscurity, he was recalled to Rome by none other than the emperors Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus, who asked him to accompany them on a military expedition against the invading barbarians. Galen was to be their personal physician. Some scholars claim that he turned down the offer to be imperial physician on the campaign, but either way, a year or so later he was made personal physician to Marcus Aurelius, and this brought him back to the city of his training, with his grateful rather than vengeful master. During Marcus Aurelius's reign, there were huge improvements in medical care in the army, and Galen must have had a hand in many of these. To keep their troops fit, they built military hospitals. Tucked away in the corner of the fort, away from the noise and bustle of the army, such a hospital was a very modern-looking institution. Passing through the wide gatehouse, a patient would enter the first wing of a square building constructed around a wide courtyard. Ahead was a light, spacious ward where new arrivals waited. Beyond was the operating theatre, projecting out into the courtyard to allow the maximum amount of light for the surgeons. At the hospital in Neuss in modern Germany, raised hearths were even found in the operating theatre. These were probably where the surgical tools were sterilized in the fire before use, just as Galen had suggested. In one corner stood a complex of baths with a block of flushing toilets attached. Hygiene was very important to doctors like Galen. In another stood the kitchens where the healthy, balanced diets required by convalescing patients were prepared. In other wings lay a series of small wards designed to reduce the risk of cross-infection, consulting rooms, a dispensary, and, for the unfortunates that even a man as great as Galen couldn't save, a mortuary. We know so much of Galen's work because, like the true Alexandrian scholar he was, he wrote prolifically. Although much has been lost, the definitive modern edition of his work, edited by K.G. Kuhn, still runs to over 20,000 pages. In these volumes he describes not only surgical procedures such as the removal of cataracts and the making of false teeth, but the correct tools with which to perform operations. Galen was very particular that his instruments should be made with iron from Noricum, which could be made into what was basically surgical steel, and his bag contained the catheters, hooks, probes, needles, bone chisels, dilators, and forceps familiar to any modern surgeon. He also hypothesized about the cause of illnesses, particularly those contagious diseases such as the plague he witnessed tearing through the troops on Verus's return from Parthia. Though as late as the 18th century many thought the cause was polluted air or some evil miasma, Galen reasoned that there were tiny particles, or bad seeds as he called them, so small they could not be seen, which carried infection. He could not have seen them. There were no microscopes in the ancient world, but using logic he inferred their existence. And he was absolutely right. Galen lived to serve another two emperors after Marcus Aurelius, dying at the great age of 87. He was clearly a doctor who took his own medical advice. Because of his insufferable arrogance, he was not popular, and few mourned his passing. Indeed, not a single statue was ever known to have been erected to him. His works, however, achieved wide circulation and were still being taught in Alexandria in 500, although they largely disappeared with the demise of the classical world. But they were rediscovered by the Arab Renaissance in the 9th century. From the late 11th century, the Arabic versions of his works were then translated into Latin and rapidly became the core teaching materials in the medical schools of medieval universities all over Europe. Galen's undoing came in 1543 at the hands of the Flemish anatomist Andreas Vesalius. As much of Galen's later work had been carried out in Rome, a city where human dissection was forbidden, he had been forced to use animals to study anatomy. When Vesalius, who had free access to human cadavers, compared what he saw in the anatomy theatre with what was written in Galen, he realized that much of Galen's work was simply wrong. The inside of a dog, or even the inside of his preferred Barbary apes, was not the same as the inside of a human. So Galen was abandoned, and even his most insightful works forgotten. What Alexandrian inquiry had made, Roman taboos had broken. Suddenly his own boast seemed rather hollow. Whoever seeks fame need only become familiar with all that I have achieved. Galen and Claudius Ptolemy were the two great scientific comets blazing their way across the star-studded cosmos of second-century Alexandria. But there was a third figure, altogether darker and more mysterious, but no less influential on the modern world. Alchemy was a subject largely scorned and dismissed by modern scientists until the great economist John Maynard Keynes bought a box full of papers in 1936 at an auction at Sotheby's in London. The papers, dismissed as of no scientific value when offered to Cambridge University 50 years earlier, had been written by none other than Sir Isaac Newton. They were almost all concerned with his lifetime passion for alchemy, and they so amazed Keynes that he felt it necessary to entirely redraw the established view of who Newton was and how his mind worked. In 1942, Keynes addressed a distinguished group of members of the Royal Society. Newton was not the first of the Age of Reason. He was the last of the magicians, the last of the Babylonians and Sumerians, the last great mind which looked out on the visible and intellectual world with the same eyes as those who began to build our intellectual inheritance rather less than 10,000 years ago. Isaac Newton, a posthumous child born with no father on Christmas Day 1642, was the last wonder child to whom the Magi could do sincere and appropriate homage. John Maynard Keynes, Newton the Man. And where did Newton get his alchemy from? Why, Alexandria, of course. The roots of alchemy lie in the origins of metallurgy, in the discovery that by applying intense heat to specific rocks, they can be purified and transformed into metal. From the very start, this process acquired occult or secret status, and the objects produced by this sacred craft, ornaments, jewelry, and currency from gold and silver, weapons and tools from copper, its alloys, and iron, were always given high prestige and value. It's clear from ancient texts that iron especially had divine qualities. The Egyptians called it the metal from heaven, the Babylonians celestial fire. These and other sources make it seem likely that people first encountered iron as meteorites which had fallen from heaven to earth. When they later discovered the same metal underground, inside the womb of Mother Earth, it must have seemed like confirmation of the metal's divine status. This notion of Mother Earth was the starting point for the alchemists. The first smiths and metallurgists were either farmers or pastoralists, both depending for their sustenance on the fecundity of the surface of the earth. When people began to extract both metals and precious stones from within the earth, from the womb of Mother Earth, they attributed life, or at least evolution, to the materials they extracted, albeit at a very different pace from the beings living on the surface. If left to gestate slowly in the womb of Mother Earth, rocks would gradually evolve into precious stones. For example, quartz was considered to be a juvenile, soft form of diamond. Likewise, lead, if left in Mother Earth's womb, would eventually transform itself into gold, and copper would develop into iron. It was therefore the task of the early smiths and forgers to accelerate this natural process of gestation by purifying metal ores through the application of heat. The alchemists' task, however, was to transform by secret occult means the base metals from one form to the next on the scale of metallic evolution. There are close parallels between Egyptian beliefs and practices concerning death and the afterlife and the theory and practice of alchemy that developed in the medieval world. More specifically, the Egyptian Book of the Dead offers precise prescriptions for the transfer of the human soul from life to death and then to rebirth in immortal form, which are extremely close to the prescriptions adopted by alchemists. No great surprise, then, that all this occult knowledge and wisdom should come to Alexandria, where it would be systematically codified into a set of mystical beliefs and procedures recognizable by the likes of Isaac Newton some 1,500 years later. The person, or persons, responsible for the Alexandrian alchemical canon is, without doubt, the most mysterious figure we shall encounter in the whole of the history of Alexandria. The canon itself is a collection of works purporting to contain secret wisdom and known collectively as the Hermetica, though the collecting was performed by a group of Italian scholars during the Renaissance. The majority of the works are concerned with alchemy and magic and are written in Greek, though there are also extant Hermetic works in Syriac, Arabic, Armenian, Coptic, and other languages. From the language of the Greek versions, it seems likely that they were written in the 2nd to 3rd century AD, though some scholars place them as early as the 1st century AD. The author names himself, or herself, as Hermes Trismegistus, that is, Hermes the Thrice Great. Hermes is the Greek name for the god of wisdom, Thoth in Egyptian. Not just the god of wisdom and alchemy, Thoth also invented writing, mathematics, music, sculpture, and astrology. So he was a crucial deity in the Egyptian pantheon, and there is some evidence that these works attributed to his earthly incarnation may be expressions of the Egyptian population of Alexandria. Though mostly written in Greek, some of their contents are clearly anti-Greek and anti-Roman, and curiously, the texts are almost never mentioned by the Alexandrian philosophers, even though they are frequently quoted by almost every other available doctrinal source. They frequently assert the superiority of the Egyptian language, and one work, the Asclepius, prophesies that there will be a bloody expulsion of foreigners from Egypt. Overall, then, it seems that these alchemical outpourings may well be the authentic voice of the ancient Egyptians, beset as they were at the time by the baying of the Romans and Greeks, the Christians and Gnostics, and all the other new cults which were thriving in Alexandria at the time. Though we tend to think of alchemy as a quick, base metal to gold, rags to riches fix, its practice, at least as expounded in Alexandria by Hermes Trismegistus, was far deeper and more complex than that. It involved, in essence, the transformation of the body into spirit in the quest for immortality. To acquire the ability to transform base metal into gold, the initiates would have to transform not just metals, but themselves as well. They had to undergo an inner death and resurrection, a baptism of fire, holding out the prospect of rebirth into immortality. Alchemical initiation was a reduction of the self to materia prima, the fluid, shapeless, fundamental state of chaos, a time of darkness and night, symbolically corresponding to the meltdown of metals from solid to liquid form. Rebirth meant entering the cosmic creation, being admitted, as it were, to the high church of the scholar, philosopher, mystic, as the filius philosophorum, son of the lovers of wisdom. These profound transformational processes guided the techniques and symbolism of the alchemist. Thus, the first stage of the alchemical process was coloured black, for the descent into darkness and primordial chaos of the underworld. The second stage produced its opposite, the colour white, symbolising purity, the quality metal attains at white-hot temperatures. The third stage was golden, an enrichment and ascent to the sun. The final stage was the blood-red of vitality after rebirth here on this earth. In this way, the alchemist was taken into the cosmos. This is Hermes Trismegistus's fourfold way, best articulated in the Emerald Tablet, an obscure text first recorded around 800, which claimed to reveal the secrets of primordial substance and its transmutations. From this first version, the short work appears to have been added to the 12th century Secret of Secrets by John of Seville, eventually finding its way into Renaissance texts and hence to Isaac Newton's laboratory, where he penned his own translation. In this he summed up the value of the occult way as he saw it. By this means you shall have ye glory of ye whole world, and thereby all obscurity shall fly from you. This was the promise that so attracted Isaac Newton. He knew perfectly well that all this talk of transforming metals was just a facade, even a cover, for a far more profound spiritual awakening. For alchemy does not trade with metals as ignorant vulgars think, which error has made them distress that noble science, but she is also material veins of whose nature God created handmaidens to conceive and bring forth its creatures. A more perfectly Alexandrian set of precepts is hard to imagine. Newton was one of the first great men of science, but few realize that his occult work, his alchemical studies, gave him the keys to the biggest breakthrough in his life. Alchemy insists that there are unseen, invisible forces at work in the universe, capable of acting on objects at a distance. An apple may or may not have dropped on Newton's head, but beyond a shadow of a doubt, it was alchemy which prompted Newton to formulate the notion of gravity. Alchemy which had been rendered into a coherent and communicable, if secret, code in Alexandria. Alchemical writings continue to emerge from Alexandria and elsewhere in Egypt in various scripts, long after the departure of the Romans and the fall of the Greek-dominated city, suggesting that as a cult it was indeed native to the peoples of Egypt. Trismegistus not only foresaw the expulsion of the foreigner, but also the demise of Egypt and the fall of the Temple of the World. He foresaw the faith of the worshippers failing and the gods leaving the earth and retreating to heaven. But he tells us that the situation is never hopeless, and as everything changes and reforms, so this great deterioration will be followed by a sudden resurgence, a rebirth that will bring back the world to its first beauty, so that this world may again be worthy of reverence and admiration, and so that God also, creator and restorer of so great a work, may be glorified by the people of that time in continual hymns of praise and blessing. Hermes Trismegistus, Hermetica. At the beginning of the 3rd century, it must have seemed to many Alexandrians that the apocalyptic moment of destruction which Hermes Trismegistus had prophesied had arrived, though the purveyor of the calamity was not a god, but a vicious Roman emperor. Chapter 16. The Ascendancy of Faith. All good moral philosophy is but a handmaid to religion. Francis Bacon, The Advancement of Learning. After Marcus Aurelius's successful visit to Alexandria, there were many in the city who believed that relations with their Roman masters were restored, and this view was endorsed when all Egyptian cities were granted a municipal council by Emperor Septimius Severus in 200. But if the people of the city believed they had woken from the rebellion of Avidius Cassius into a new Roman dawn, it was to prove a false one. Alexandria was used to speaking its mind, and Rome did not always like what it heard. Septimius Severus had 2 sons, and it was his wish that both should succeed him on the imperial throne. Though the 2 boys, Aurelius Antoninus and Geta, were only 11 months different in age, they loathed each other from early childhood. To try to generate some rapprochement between the two, the aging Septimius took them off to Britain, where he placed his younger son, Geta, in charge of civil affairs, while Aurelius Antoninus commanded the army in their campaigns against the northern barbarians. It was here that Antoninus got the nickname by which he would be remembered from thenceforth, Caracalla, from the hooded Gallic tunic or Caracallus that he always wore. After 2 years in Britain, on February 4, 211, Septimius died at York, and the 2 boys were declared joint emperors. They determined to return immediately to Rome to arrange their father's funeral, but such was their mutual antagonism that during the entire journey back they never travelled or ate together, and they slept every night in separate houses. Back in Rome, the imperial palace was split in half, doors were sealed, and guards were mounted at every entrance, as if each half of the building was under siege. The only hope of resolving the latent civil war lay with the 2 boys' mother, Julia Domna, a formidable woman who was renowned for her coteries of learned men, including Galen. Edward Gibbon, the famed 18th-century classicist, is full of praise. She possessed, even in old age, the attractions of beauty, and united to a lively imagination, a firmness and strength of judgment seldom bestowed on her sex. In her son's reign she administered the principal affairs of state of the empire with a prudence that supported his authority and with a moderation which sometimes corrected his wild extravagances. Julia applied herself to letters and philosophy with some success and with the most splendid reputation. She was the patroness of every art and the friend of every man of genius. Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. That is not to say, however, that the somewhat prudish Gibbon found her character to be faultless. The more salacious ancient sources also suggest that Julia enjoyed more than just mental stimulation from the men around her, and Gibbon was forced to rather elliptically point out that if those sources were true, then chastity was very far from being the most conspicuous virtue of the Empress Julia. Naturally, it fell upon Julia to attempt to resolve her son's differences. She convinced Caracalla to meet with his brother in her apartments to attempt a reconciliation, but the minute Jita entered the room he was set upon by a troop of Caracalla's men. According to the contemporary chronicler Cassius Dio, Jita died in his mother's arms, while his faithless brother ran, blood-soaked, to the camp of the Praetorian Guard, pretending he had escaped an ambush aimed at assassinating both of them. Now absolute ruler of the Roman Empire, Caracalla soon showed his true colours. There followed an appalling bloodletting in Rome in which all of Jita's supporters and their families, men, women and children, were slaughtered, one contemporary observer putting the figure at 20,000 dead. It was also rapidly becoming clear that the emperor's megalomania would allow for no criticism. Anyone who dared to offer a different opinion, from senators down to the charioteer Eupropes, who showed enthusiasm for a cause that the emperor opposed, was summarily executed. This alone should have been warning enough to the outspoken Alexandrians, but already growing in the emperor's mind was an idea that would have far worse consequences for them. Caracalla was rapidly coming to the belief that he was the new Alexander, destined to recapture the Macedonians' empire in the east. According to Cassius Dio, he carried with him items that were said to have belonged to Alexander, including his personal weapons and the cups he was supposed to have drunk from. He created a new army unit, a traditional phalanx made up of 16,000 Macedonian soldiers, which he armed with period weapons already half a millennium out of date. From his reading of the histories of Alexander, he had also come to believe that Aristotle had taken a part in his hero's murder, so Caracalla persecuted Aristotelian philosophers, arguing that their books should be burned and ordering the abolition of their communal dining room in the museum in Alexandria. But it was when the emperor arrived in Alexandria in person that its citizens realized just what they had to fear from a man who considered himself the heir of their founder's destiny. At the time, certain Alexandrian satires appear to have been in circulation that criticized the murder of Jita and lambasted the emperor's claims to be another Alexander. In response, he decided to visit the city in the winter of 215-16. His mission was ostensibly intellectual and religious, as Caracalla had a passion for religious institutions, having already stayed at the famous temple of Asclepius in Pergamum, where Galen trained and received all the holy rites there. According to Cassius Dio, however, this was just a subterfuge. When Caracalla reached the suburbs, he stopped, and waited for the leading citizens of the city to come to meet him, as was customary. This they did, bringing with them the sacred symbols of the city and their offices. The emperor, in apparently jovial spirits, met them and led them to believe that they would enjoy a banquet and entertainments with the royal retinue before proceeding into the city. When they were thus put off their guard, he had them all slaughtered. The emperor then marched into the city, taking up residence in the Serapeum and attending the temple's sacrifices and other rites. As he considered himself both a deeply religious man and a scholar, he doubtless also took advantage of the extensive library housed in this temple, although we cannot imagine that any Aristotelian texts housed there fared well. But if Caracalla hoped the chastised inhabitants of the city would now take him as their new Alexander, he was badly mistaken. Sporadic rioting seems to have erupted in the city, and rumours flew around town that the emperor intended to marry his mother, Julia, an idea Caracalla perhaps thought Egyptians would appreciate. Instead, it was whispered that he was Oedipus and his mother Jocasta. Incestuous marriage might have been allowable among divine pharaohs, but in Roman emperors it was laughable. Revenge was swift. Caracalla ordered all the young men of the city arrested, regardless of their race or creed. He then unleashed upon the city his army, which set to looting and pillaging. Next he had the city cordoned off into zones to prevent freedom of movement, and suspended the local games, abolished all the communal messes of the museum, and revoked all Roman privileges. Finally, he gave the order which would scar the city's life for generations to come, so that no one would forget what they called the Fury of Caracalla. The young men seized during the looting were taken to the city walls and systematically slaughtered. Within a few hours, the flower of Alexandria's youth, some 25,000 young men, lay dead. And then, as a last tilt at his tormentors, Caracalla had the governor of the city publicly executed. Fortunately, Caracalla's reign of terror was not to last, and ironically, this ruthless emperor would meet his end pursuing yet another act of religious devotion. According to the colourful, but not overly reliable, Historia Augusta, in the spring of 217 he set off to make a visit to the temple of the moon god at Carrhae, accompanied only by a select corps of bodyguards. On the way back he stopped to defecate, and at that moment a bodyguard named Martialis struck him down, only to be killed moments later by a loyal Scythian archer. The emperor died quickly. The scars he inflicted on Alexandria would take longer to heal. Caracalla had certainly taught the Alexandrians a lesson they would never forget, but if he thought he had cowed them into silent submission in the process, he was very wrong. From then on, the city would be a focus of discontent and rebellion, and thus an almost irresistible magnet for rebellious generals and would-be emperors who would be welcomed into the city with open arms. It is uncertain just what effect the Fury of Caracalla had on the museum and library, beyond the statement in Cassius Dio that the emperor abolished the communal messes of the Alexandrians. This may refer simply to the dining clubs in the city, but may also refer to the communal dining halls of the museum, where the scholars, who held everything in common, ate together. Considering his loathing of the Aristotelians, this is not unlikely. Academic life in the city was clearly not extinguished, however, as the few details we have of one of the great mathematicians of this era confirm. Diophantus of Alexandria, a Hellenized Babylonian, was probably just a child at the time of the Fury, but he survived it, and went on to master enough of the knowledge left in the museum for him to become one of the greatest mathematicians of his or any age. By adapting Babylonian techniques, and concentrating on arithmetic rather than geometry, he invented a whole new area of mathematics, where numbers were replaced with symbols, allowing problems to be solved for any number, not just specific instances. As such, he has become known as the Father of Algebra, the originator of the hugely complex collections of Greek letters and symbols which fill the blackboards of modern mathematicians and the exercise books of their often baffled students. Indeed, it was his book, the Arithmetica, a collection of 130 problems and their various solutions, that inspired one of the most complicated pieces of mathematical research of all time. When the great 17th century mathematician Pierre de Fermat wrote in the margins of his copy of the Arithmetica that he had discovered a remarkable proof of a theorem suggested by Diophantus, he also noted that he hadn't the space to prove it there. Sadly, he never found time to write it out anywhere else either, setting off a 357-year mathematical search for the proof to what became known as Fermat's last theorem. The problem, originated in the 2nd century and formulated in the 17th, was not finally published until 1995, in a paper so complex that most modern mathematicians still don't fully understand it. Nor was this the only riddle Diophantus left behind. As with so many Alexandrians, it can be painfully difficult to extract personal details from his work. But the father of algebra did leave us his own mathematical clues. His epitaph describing his life is itself an algebraic problem. This tomb holds Diophantus. Ah, what a marvel! And the tomb tells scientifically the measure of his life. God vouchsafed that he should be a boy for the sixth part of his life. When a twelfth was added, his cheeks acquired a beard. He kindled for him the light of marriage after a seventh, and in the fifth year after his marriage he granted him a son. Alas, late begotten and miserable child, when he had reached the measure of half his father's life, the chill grave took him. After consoling his grief by this science of numbers 4 years, he reached the end of his life. Epitaph recorded in W. Gunyon, A Century of Translations from the Greek Anthology. Those with mathematical talents can rewrite the above as two equations which can be solved simultaneously, to discover something of Diophantus's life. From this we learn that his boyhood lasted 14 years. He entered his majority at 21, was married at 33, and had a son at 38. His son died aged 42, while Diophantus lived on into great old age, dying 4 years later, aged 84. Diophantus's biographical riddles may have illuminated the twilight of Alexandrian mathematics, but it was the spiritual investigations of the Alexandrians of this turbulent age that were now having the most profound effect, not just on their city, but on the world as a whole. Uncertain times drive many to question the nature of the world and the motives of the gods, or even their very existence. Any Alexandrian street philosopher could have told you that Caracalla wasn't divine, but the question as to what was divine increasingly vexed the inhabitants of the museum. Strangely, for both the main schools of thought that would fight for supremacy in the city's final days, the answer came not from the porticos of the library, but from the waterfront. The somewhat unlikely father of this process was a man named Ammonius Saccas. Born into a very poor family, he may initially have had a Christian upbringing in the institution which preceded Pantaenus's catechetical school. After school, Ammonius went to work on the Alexandrian harbour front as a porter or sack-bearer, hence his second name, Saccas. There he enjoyed a second education, talking to the traders and captains with their travellers' tales of distant lands, surprising customs, and alien religions. For anyone who wanted to learn of the world, these wharves and quays were a university in themselves, a gathering together of people and goods from the whole known world, the most cosmopolitan place on earth. It was a setting to get anyone thinking, and that's exactly what Ammonius Saccas did, both on the dockside and in the public lectures in the pagan philosophy schools which he attended after work. Ammonius was not content to follow any one school of thought, however, but was all the time developing his own theories. Indeed, so deeply did he think about what he heard during the days that, it was said, these ideas followed him into his dreams at night, and during these dreams he found his insights. That was how he came to be known as Theodidactos, or God-taught, though he referred to himself as merely a Philolethean, a lover of the truth. At some point in the early 3rd century, perhaps even during the upheavals of the Fury, Ammonius set up his own school of philosophy. He taught only orally, and like Pythagoras, he bound his advanced students with a vow of secrecy, so it is difficult to discover what his actual philosophy was. There is a further complication in understanding Ammonius, in that he was formally adopted as the founder of theosophy by the spiritualist medium H. P. Blavatsky, when she founded the Theosophical Society in 1875. This led to an enormous amount of speculation about Ammonius's life and thoughts, and a considerable attribution of eccentric Victorian quasi-religious ideas about universal brotherhoods and the like to Ammonius, with virtually no evidence to support it. However, the pupils that Ammonius attracted do throw some light on the man and his ideas. Two of these pupils would go on to become the most influential thinkers and authors of the 3rd century. From them we learn that Ammonius was very selective in allowing pupils to attend his school, taking on only a few pupils every year. His pupils were initially divided into 3 groups, novices, initiates, and masters, and he divided his teachings into 2 sections, the exoteric and the esoteric. This division was very widespread at the time, and can be traced to many early philosophers, including Pythagoras. The exoteric teachings were openly available to all, and were characteristically ethical, like the ones Ammonius himself attended as a young man. These were the lectures that the public could attend. The esoteric, or greater mysteries, were different. These were taught in private, and were reserved for the fully trained and dedicated few. Here Ammonius's pupils learned of his notion of absolute deity, utterly transcendent and indescribable, something that both Christ and Plato could agree upon. He believed that the human soul was an immortal radiation from the universal soul, or ether, and that gave every individual the possibility of experiencing divinity. But he also considered that there was a universal ethical basis within all metaphysical systems, and that in essence all philosophies and religions shared this universal ethical and spiritual foundation. In short, therefore, there was no underlying conflict between the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle, and even Christ's teaching could be seen as an authentic expression of the timeless wisdom. In this way, his views came to be known as eclectic, capable of embracing all religious and philosophical systems. Ammonius also posited that the best way to understand all sacred myths, legends, and mysteries was to interpret them by analogy, seeking correspondences between them and thus revealing the universality of their content. In this he is, of course, methodologically aligned with his illustrious Jewish predecessor, Philo. As his most able students began to employ these ideas, they became known as analogeticists. The broad base of Ammonius's philosophy attracted students from a wide range of philosophical backgrounds, and among the most able of those were two young men who between them would describe the shape of Alexandria's last years. The first of these was a Greek speaker with a Roman name who was probably born in Egypt in 205, Plotinus. Because Ammonius himself left no written testimony, the title of founder of the pagan movement that became known as Neoplatonism is usually given to Plotinus, although his own ideas were certainly born out of what he had heard from Ammonius in those secret lectures. Neoplatonism was not merely a revival of Plato's teaching, but a whole new interpretation and development of his philosophy, as closely related to the original as, say, Protestantism is to Catholicism. Plotinus's philosophical ideas began with his physical being, and they were none too flattering. Recalling that in Plato's cosmos, the waking, conscious world of humans and nature was the most debased and corrupted level of existence, he took the idea much more personally. He could hardly bear the thought that his soul was trapped in so base a thing as his body, which he sometimes called a detestable vessel, one which acted as an obstacle to spiritual development. He insisted that to rise up to very truth is altogether to depart from bodies. Corporeality is contrary to soul, and essentially opposed to soul. In a similar ascetic vein, he refused to reveal his birthday, as he did not wish his friends to celebrate it, avoided eating meat, and took a daily massage instead of indulging in the rather Roman luxury of bathing. When a pupil, friend, and physician suggested he sit for a portrait, he castigated the unfortunate doctor, roaring that surely it was bad enough to be entrapped in the form in which nature had cast him without making an image of that image, as if that would be something worth staring upon. Much of this idea of self must have come from the diminutive Alexandrian porter whom Plotinus first met when, at 27, he came to Alexandria in search of a philosophy teacher. At first he was depressed and disappointed with the offerings in the public lecture halls, until a friend mentioned Ammonius. They went to one of his lectures, after which Plotinus exclaimed, "This was the man I was looking for." He stayed with Ammonius for 11 years, then decided he would travel to the east in search of the philosophies of the Persians, Chaldeans, and Indians. To this end he got himself attached to the army of the Roman Emperor Gordian III, which was intent on invading Persia. However, Gordian was assassinated before he reached his destination, and Plotinus found himself abandoned in the wilderness. It took him the best part of 2 years to make his way back to Antioch, and from there he took a ship to Rome, where he lived the rest of his life. He never returned to the city that had nurtured his dream. In Rome, Plotinus quickly became something of a star, commanding the respect of the emperor and his wife, along with many prominent citizens, particularly some of the more important and influential women. So deeply was he revered that several families decided to endow him with property and income in exchange for educating their children. So his house became full of young boys and girls who mixed with senators and foreign students, even Alexandrians, who had become his pupils. One of his most able students was Malchus of Tyros, who was known in Rome as Porphyry, a humorous allusion to the purple robes of the emperor. It was he who eventually persuaded his master that for posterity's sake he must break with Ammonius's injunction never to write down the secrets of his philosophy and commit his teachings to paper. So from about the age of 50, Plotinus started to record his ideas, his dialogues with his students, and his lecture notes. But he was not a patient scribe. His handwriting was tiny and very untidy, and he cared not a jot for spelling. Fortunately for us, Porphyry was the soul of patience and tact, and he both copied and edited Plotinus's meanderings, later completing the work and considerably reordering it, as well as writing a biography of his master, before the work was finally published under the title of the Enneads, meaning Groups of Nine, each book consisting of nine discussions. In the Enneads, we can look into the mind of the last great pagan philosopher of antiquity. Plotinus's universe is, broadly speaking, of a similar structure to Plato's, graded in the great chain of being from the divine to the mundane, from the eternal to the mortal, from God the One to nature, matter, and the observed world. At the top of this hierarchy is the One, beyond all categories of being and non-being. It is totally indivisible and even unthinkable. It is both self-caused and the cause of everything else in the universe. Thought cannot be applied to the One, as that would imply a distinction between the thinker and the object being thought of. The One is both thinker and thought. The One is the source of the world, not through any act of creation, though, as activity cannot be ascribed to this unchangeable idea. From this One, then, come emanations, which are, of necessity, less perfect than the One, and which make up our universe. The first of these is thought, or intellect, nous. Intellect is the home of all of Plato's forms, the repository of the cognitive identity of all things, and the way we recognize things to be as they are, by perceiving them in ideal type. Intellect thus provides the principle or essence of all things. And from intellect emanates the soul. Soul is related by analogy to intellect in the same way that intellect is related to the One. That is, put crudely, intellect is the sum of all the souls in existence. Beneath soul is mere matter, the stuff of the universe, including our own bodies, which Plotinus so despised. With respect to soul, Plotinus departs from Plato by splitting it in two. His view is that in all things, and especially people, there is an upper soul, which remains pure, divine, and untarnished eternally, and there is a lower soul, which, though it is actually divine, may become tarnished and forget its divine origin, as it provides the motivation for material beings, in our own cases our bodies, to find their way through the trials of a conscious life. In Plotinus's view, the way to discover our upper soul and restore our tarnished lower soul is through ethics. The keys to human salvation are thus the cultivation of virtue, which refreshes the soul with divine beauty, the practice of dialectics, debate, which reveals the true nature of souls, and finally through contemplation, which is the proper occupation of the purified soul. Let every soul recall, then, at the outset, the truth that soul is the author of all living things, that it has breathed the life into them all, whatever is nourished by earth and sea, all the creatures of the air, the divine stars in the sky. It is the maker of the sun, itself formed and ordered this vast heaven, and conducts all that rhythmic motion, and it is a principle distinct from all these, to which it gives law and movement and life, and it must of necessity be more honourable than they, for they gather or dissolve as soul brings them life or abandons them. But soul, since it never can abandon itself, is of eternal being. Plotinus, Enneads. The legacy of these ideas was enormous, not just in the last days of the pagan ancient world, but throughout later history. In the later classical world, the theological traditions of Christianity, most particularly in the work of St. Augustine, Islam and Judaism, all looked to Platonic philosophy as described by Plotinus as a method for formulating and articulating their own theologies. After the obscurity of the medieval period, the Enneads re-emerged in 1492 as one of the driving forces behind the writings of the Italian Renaissance philosophers and in the works of humanists like Erasmus and Thomas More. Plotinus's influence further continued into the 17th century in the works of the Cambridge Platonists, and by the 18th century, Plotinus was recognized as one of the formative influences on Western Christianity. As the classicist Lempriere noted, "He was the favorite of all the Romans, and while he charmed the populace by the force of his eloquence and the Senate by his doctrines, the Emperor Gallienus courted him and admired the extent of his learning. He was a great mystic, and his Neoplatonism had a profound effect upon the theology and philosophy of the Christian Church. Lompréard. The German idealists of the following century, especially Hegel, considered Plotinus's work the basis for their opposition to the growing schools of scientific philosophy, and his influence can even be traced in the 20th century Christian imaginative literature in England, spearheaded by C.S. Lewis. Few philosophies have lasted so long, appealing to so many peoples of different nations and from different times, all of whom have in their own ways tried to live up to Plotinus's last injunction, as recorded by his student and personal physician, Eustochius of Alexandria, as the master lay on his deathbed. Strive to give back the divine in yourselves to the divine in the all. Only one other philosophy has lasted as many centuries as that of Plotinus, and it was championed by his own fellow student in the secret lectures of Ammonius Saccas. He was about 20 years older than Plotinus, and of the other great emerging school of thought in Alexandria, Christianity. Origen, or more properly, Origenes Adamantius, was born and brought up in Alexandria as a Christian by his father Leonides, a Greek teacher, and his mother, who was Jewish and taught him to sing the Psalms in Hebrew. His father gave him an excellent education, and as an adolescent he attended the lectures of both Clement at the catechetical school and those of Ammonius in his school of philosophy. His precocious brilliance attracted such attention, it is said, that by the time he was 17 his father was known as Leonides, father of Origen. But in that year, 202, the Emperor Septimus Severus ordered another of the periodic persecutions of Christians, and Leonides was dragged from his house by Roman soldiers. Origen, the oldest of 7 children, insisted upon accompanying his father, but according to the story, his mother hid his shoes or his clothes. Still, he followed his father to the Caesareum, where he saw him executed, his head thrown onto a pile of heads, his body cast aside. As was the practice in those days, all of the Christian Leonides' property was confiscated by the state, and Origen, his mother, and his 6 brothers were left destitute. Origen was forced to provide for his family by teaching and copying manuscripts, until a new opportunity was presented to him by the Bishop of Alexandria. The pogrom which had taken his father's life was the one that led Bishop Clement of Alexandria to abandon the catechetical school and seek refuge in Palestine. So the next year Bishop Demetrius appointed Origen as the new dean of the school at just 18 years old. Origen's reformed school was open to all, and taught a wide range of subjects besides Christian doctrine. Prayer and fasting were practiced by teacher and pupil alike, and simplicity of lifestyle was encouraged. It was clearly an immensely stimulating environment, and one of Origen's pupils, Gregory, later known as Thaumaturgus, wonder worker, recalled that they were given complete freedom to find their way around the entire world of knowledge, and to investigate anything which took their interest, enjoying any mode of teaching and savouring the sweet pleasures of the intellect. To be under the intellectual charge of Origen was like living in a garden where fruits of the mind sprang up without toil, to be happy with gladness by the happy occupants. He truly was a paradise to us after the likeness of the paradise of God, and to leave him was to renascent the experience of Adam and the fall. Gregory Thaumaturgus, address to Origen. Origen himself is said to have taught all day and studied the Bible for much of each night, leading a life of exemplary asceticism. Perhaps because many of his students were women, and also because at that time he wished to follow the gospel to the letter, one report claims he decided to obey the words of Matthew literally, and mutilate himself. The passage from Matthew 19:12 concerns the nature of eunuchs, both those who are born that way and those who decide to take matters into their own hands, for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Matthew ends the discussion with the words, "He that is able to receive it, let him receive it." And this Origen took as a direct order. There is some debate as to whether Origen did actually castrate himself, and it has been argued that he put the story about to mask his own homosexuality, though there is no evidence to support what sounds like a slur from his detractors. Later in life he admitted that it was an extreme act, and probably beyond the call of his faith. For 10 years, Origen devoted himself to teaching, with only two short breaks, a brief visit to Rome in 211-12, and a journey to Arabia at the request of the prefect of the province in 213 or 214, during which he visited the rose-red city of Petra. On his return, he became friendly with Ambrose of Alexandria, a wealthy man whom Origen converted from Valentinian Gnosticism, a heretical Christian sect formed by the original St. Valentine, to Orthodox Christianity. From then on, he acted as Origen's sponsor and promoter. When the fury of Caracalla was unleashed on the city, Origen and Ambrose fled to Caesarea together. Around 218, Ambrose of Alexandria made a formal agreement with Origen to promote his writings, and thereafter all his published works were dedicated to Ambrose. With the help of 7 stenographers to take dictation in relays, another 7 scribes to prepare long-hand copies, and a team of girls to make copies of the copies, Origen's output was phenomenal. He set to work on a huge commentary on the Bible, 2 books on the resurrection, and one of the most important works in early Christian literature, On First Principles, in which he began to lay out a systematic analysis of his vision of the Christian faith. Over the following 20 years, Origen set about teaching and writing, organizing his textual criticism of the Bible by the Alexandrian method. To do this, he took the unusual and hugely significant step of mastering Hebrew, the language in which the Bible had first arrived in Alexandria. Having mastered the language, he then gathered together all the known versions of the Old Testament in Hebrew and Greek, and systematically compared them all. Origen accepted the notion of the Holy Trinity, but he gave it a hierarchy. As in Plato, God the Father is the one, the omnipotent, all-encompassing, purely spiritual being. God the Son, however, is a product of the One, equivalent to Logos, or Wisdom, Sophia, in Neoplatonism, the first emanation. The Holy Spirit, third element of the Trinity, emanates from the Son, and is related to the Son as the Son is to the Father. A passage of Origen's writing preserved in the original Greek explains his position. The God and Father who holds the universe together is superior to every being that exists, for he imports to each one from his existence that which each one is. The Son, being less than the Father, is superior to rational creatures alone, for he is second to the Father. The Holy Spirit is still less, and dwells within the saints alone. So that in this way the power of the Father is greater than that of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and in turn the power of the Holy Spirit exceeds that of every other holy being. Origen, De Principiis. This is a masterful synthesis of classical Platonic and mystical Christian perspectives. But it was this application of Neoplatonic cosmology to the Holy Trinity which would eventually lead to Origen's expulsion from the Roman Catholic Church several centuries later. Origen is quite close to Plotinus in his view of the human soul. Though he doesn't differentiate the soul into upper and lower parts, he does state that in the first creation, human souls were close to and warmed by God. He sees Jesus as a perfect product of this first creation, his soul still warm and intimately close to God, his Father. But the fall led the rest of humanity's souls to fall away from God and become cool. The job of the faith is to return us to God's warmth and love. An absolutely central tenet of Origen's theology is the resurrection of all beings, even ultimately the devil, his argument being that God would not create anything, even Satan, if he did not want all of creation to be saved at the end of time. The devil, however, did seem to be snapping at Origen's heels. His work was repeatedly interrupted by persecutions. In 235, it is said, he was forced to hide in a house in Caesarea, where he stayed in hiding for 2 years. During this period, he wrote a book appropriately entitled On Martyrdom, which is preserved in a later text, The Exhortation to Martyrdom. Origen is best remembered today for a work that we have already met. In 248, his old friend Ambrose, aware of the growing sophistication of anti-Christian literature, particularly among the Neoplatonists, prevailed upon him to write 8 books refuting the damning critique of their religion composed by Celsus. This collection, Against Celsus, became the most celebrated defence of the faith produced by the early Church, partly because it inadvertently preserved Celsus's own work. It also opens a window onto the dangerous religious politics of the day and shows the real fear and danger that lay behind the ethereal arguments of the philosophers. Here we see Origen not as simply the defender of the faith, but as a man who knew that Celsus's clever words were often backed up by the tip of a sword, and that where persuasion failed, the empire was quite happy to force conformity. In dealing with Celsus's complaint that Christians were secretive, whereas other great iconoclasts, like Socrates, had been prepared to speak openly, regardless of the risk, when they knew themselves to be right, Origen answered that the situation was now different. Socrates had died for his philosophy, and in the process proved the Athenians wrong. This they had quickly realized. Rome, however, had not learned from the deaths of many Christians. But in the case of the Christians, the Roman Senate and the princes of the time, and the soldiery, and the people, and the relatives of those who had become converts to the faith, made war upon their doctrine. Prophetic words these turned out to be, as 2 years later what he termed the whole world's conspiracy against Christianity caught up with Origen himself. In 250 he was captured during yet another pogrom, this time ordered by the emperor Decius. Bound hand and foot for days on end, Origen was repeatedly tortured. But Decius died before him, and the old man was released. Crippled and broken, he died of his wounds shortly afterward. By the time of his death, Origen had done a thoroughly Alexandrian job on Christianity. In so doing, he portrayed his religion for the Hellenistic world as a faith with a philosophy, not simply another localized cult. This was a religion that now offered a whole cosmology, not just the forlorn hope of a better life after death, for those whose current life was almost unbearably hard. This was a religion that the scholars of the museum could understand. Origen's life work was an act of integration, the conversion of a blind faith into a rationalized set of ideas, a plausible worldview and system of thought and action designed to elevate its practitioners in this world and the next. The two disciples of the Alexandrian porter, Ammonius Saccas, had accomplished extraordinary feats, the codification of the last great pagan philosophy of the ancient world, and of the primary philosophy of the world that would follow. Yet these two ideas were not destined to grow happily side by side, and in Ammonius's secret lectures had been planted the seeds of Alexandria's destruction. Chapter 17. The End of Reason. The Dream of Reason Produces Monsters. Goya, Los Capricos. If Alexandria was the ideal crucible in which to forge new ideas about God and divinity, it was not prepared for the firestorm those new ideas would unleash. Alexandria was the city that questioned everything, from the shape of the earth to the divinity of the emperors. But not all of its subjects took this academic criticism well. The earth had not complained when Eratosthenes had measured it. Triangles, circles, and cones had quietly surrendered their secrets to Euclid. But while a difference of opinion in geometry or astronomy was just that, a difference of opinion in religion was heresy. Opinions were met with counter-opinions. Heresy was met with persecution and often death. So it was with explosive results that the greatest heresy of the early Christian Church emerged in the one city with the pedigree to have created it. Arius may not have been born in Alexandria, being of Libyan and Berber descent, but he arrived in the city in the later years of the 3rd century, and from that point on he would make it his only home. He had chosen a career in the fledgling church, but his questioning, some would say confrontational, perhaps even Alexandrian nature, had made his rise uneven. In particular, he had shown a dislike of the dogmatic authorities of the day, represented by Alexander, the patriarch of his home city. In an age when the church was obsessed with schism and heresy, arguing over the exact interpretation of the nature of God, Arius was almost deliberately provocative, backing schismatic causes, and twice getting himself excommunicated while still just a presbyter. So it was that from what should have been a simple lecture by the patriarch to his young charges arose the greatest and most damaging heresy in the early church. The church father, Socrates Scholasticus, tells us that Alexander had chosen to lecture his pupils, including Arius, on a particularly tricky subject. He had decided to speak in detail, too much detail, according to Socrates, about the greatest theological mystery of all, the unity of the Trinity, or how the Godhead was three parts, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, yet also just one part, and hence all equal. Arius, ever quizzical and ready for an argument, took the bait, according to Socrates, simply to annoy his master. A certain one of the presbyters under his jurisdiction, whose name was Arius, possessed of no inconsiderable logical acumen, from love of controversy, took the opposite opinion, and, as he thought, vigorously responded to what was said by the bishop. If, said he, the Father begat the Son, he that was begotten had a beginning of existence, and from this it is evident that there was a time when the Son was not. It therefore necessarily follows that he had his substance from nothing. Socrates Scholasticus, Ecclesiastical History. It was a perfectly logical piece of argument, and had this been a debate on logic in the porticos of the museum, Arius might have expected some applause. But this was not a matter of logic, not a matter which Alexander wished to discuss. This was an article of faith, a matter of belief, and his presbyters were meant to accept it without question. Arius would not, and, receiving no conclusive answer to his point, began to elaborate his own idea further, acquiring his own adherents, and, as Socrates put it, thus from a little spark a large fire was kindled. Encouraged by the response from some Christians, Arius travelled to his friend Eusebius of Nicomedia, where he began codifying his ideas in a book that would turn that fire into an inferno. In this book, known as The Banquet, or in Greek, Thalia, Arius proposed that God the Father was the only God, and that Christ was created by him, not an integral part of him. Today this may seem a rather dry and academic point, but in Alexandria it was dynamite. The idea created a sensation, and the inns and churches of Alexandria were soon filled with arguments over the true nature of Christ. In the marble colonnades, street philosophers argued for and against the idea, while the doctrine rapidly became the talk of Christian society. That Arius had written his work in an easily read, populist style made it even more fashionable. But the arguments were not confined to the political exchanges of the museum, or even the soapbox harangues of the street preachers. In an early church, battered and bruised from numerous bloody persecutions, desperately trying to assert its authority, arguments over Arius and his Arianism often ended in bloodshed. The doctrine, in effect, created a turf war between two opposing factions of the Church, each of which, of course, claimed to hold the only true interpretation of the faith. As emperors came and went, so bishops and priests of each camp were excommunicated and exiled, reinstated and returned. The atmosphere was highly inflammatory, with both parties claiming their opponents were responsible for terrible atrocities, most of which probably never happened, but all of which served to further enrage the street mobs and radical monks that both camps used to support their campaigns. In the end, the Christian emperor Constantine, who had himself converted to Christianity, at least nominally bringing the Roman Empire with him, decided to intervene. So he wrote to the head of each faction, the Patriarch Alexander and Arius, in an attempt to ease passions, suggesting that they differed only on the interpretation of a small and obscure point of doctrine. Remembering the reputation of the city where the fight was raging, he patiently reminded them, "You are well aware that even the philosophers themselves are united under one sect, yet they often differ from each other on some parts of their theories. But although they may differ on the very highest branches of science, in order to maintain the unity of their body, they still agree to coalesce. Now, if this is done among them, how much more equitable will it be for you, who have been constituted ministers of the Most High God, to become unanimous with one another in such a religious profession?" A letter of the Emperor Constantine in Socrates Scholasticus, Ecclesiastical History. Despite this eminently sensible attempt to pour oil on troubled waters, neither the Arians nor their opponents were prepared to listen, nor were they about to do as Constantine had suggested. The religious ideas now coming out of the city may have been created in an atmosphere of tolerance, but having defined their own positions, they would allow no further debate or diversion. This radicalism had been born in Alexandria and grown in Alexandrian soil, and it would poison and eventually kill the city that had nurtured it. As Alexander would allow no differences in religion, so eventually the whole Christian church was forced to choose. And in 325, a weary Constantine ordered the bishops to gather in council at Nicaea to decide once and for all what the official church did and did not believe. The result was the Nicene Creed, still used in churches today. In it, there was no place for Arianism. Patriarch Alexander seemed to have won, and Arius was banished. Some of the credit for Alexander's apparent triumph at Nicaea must go to his deacon, Athanasius. He was a young and fervent Christian who had accompanied the patriarch to the council as his secretary, having already served at his side for several years. Athanasius was a unique product of his time, and a man who could have been produced only by the city of his childhood, Alexandria. Here, he had received the education still traditional among the wealthier elements of society, learning grammar and rhetoric before finishing his education in the lecture halls of the philosophers of the museum. He had then thrown himself into the life and controversies of the church, witnessing firsthand both the sophisticated academic arguments in the city for and against Arianism and the stark fundamentalist Christianity of the desert monks, who from this date would play an increasing role in his city's fortunes. Contemporaries describe him as relatively short and thin, but full of energy, his finely shaped head crowned with sparse auburn hair. He was said to have a ready wit, be affable in company, pleasant in conversation, and quick to learn. But the passion of his religion betrayed itself in his unyielding and unsparing debating style. If there was an Alexandrian to answer Arius's criticism, it was he, and his rise through the church hierarchy was rapid, until at just 33, on the death of his mentor, he found himself the new patriarch of his home city. 4th-century Alexandria was as idiosyncratic and energetic as its new patriarch. The Ptolemaic Temple of Serapis still functioned, and pagan philosophers still bowed to the great cult statue there, created centuries before by Bryaxis. Nearby, the Jewish synagogues familiar to Philo, and perhaps even the writers of the Septuagint, still flourished, and in between them Christian churches had now sprung up. In the streets, the pagan fortune-tellers still offered glimpses of the future to those with a few coins in their pockets, while populist, Neoplatonist, and evangelical monks vied for the ears and hearts of passers-by. In this multicultural, multilingual milieu, the new patriarch began his turbulent career, one that would change the face of his city and his religion forever. Athanasius inherited one niggling problem from Alexander. Arianism, though condemned at Nicaea, was not dead, despite the death of Arius himself, who, one church father claimed, died when, seized with the realization of his own wickedness, he became so incontinent that he passed his own bowels. Under a series of weak emperors, the fortunes of pro- and anti-Arian factions waxed and waned, during which time Athanasius was alternately fated and denounced, expelled and reconciled. During his episcopate, he was variously charged with sorcery, corruption, and murder. Somewhere between 5 and 7 times he was driven from his city and forced to take refuge with the desert monks in Western Europe, and once even in his own father's tomb. But for each reverse, there was a restoration, and Athanasius himself recorded in ever more polemical detail his changes of fortune, stoking the political fires in Alexandria. On the occasion of one return, the Arians claimed that people complained, and even wept at the news of his return, and refused to meet with him. He responded furiously, referring to himself in the third person. Now such was not the case, but quite the contrary, joy and cheerfulness prevailed, and the people ran together, hastening to obtain the desired sight of him. The churches were full of rejoicings, and thanksgivings were offered up to the Lord everywhere. And all the ministers and clergy beheld him with such feelings that their souls were possessed with delight, and they esteemed that the happiest day of their lives. Athanasius, the Orations of St. Athanasius against the Arians. Every swing of the Arian pendulum brought a more emphatic, more violent, more fundamentalist response from the protagonists. Athanasius himself was now known as Athanasius Contra Mundum, Athanasius against the world. Suspicions were stoked, factions formed, sects became mobs, and their cry in the streets was not think, but simply choose. Perhaps, fortunately, Athanasius would not live to see the end results of his church's radicalization. After an exhausting and turbulent career, he died peacefully in his bed, having spent a lifetime fighting for the view of Christianity that he had heard agreed to at Nicaea, a fight which would gain him the titles Doctor of the Church and the Father of Orthodoxy. On these foundations would be built the medieval Catholic Church, but they would be laid in the ruins of the city he had ruled.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.